Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is your host, Peng Fei Zhao, speaking to you from Gainesville, Florida. Today, I will be talking with Patricia Gandaham and Zhang Yongyi on their new book, Schools Under Siege, The Impact of Immigration Enforcement on Educational Equity, published this year by the Harvard Education Press. Much has been reported about the hotly debated issue of immigration enforcement. Yet the question is still to be explored. What is the impact of the immigration enforcement on schools and our educational system? In Schools Under Siege, Patricia and Zhang Yang addressed this question using rich and comprehensive data from their studies. More than 6 million school-aged children and youth live in a household in which at least one of their close family members is undocumented. In today's program, Patricia and Zhang Yang joined me to discuss what immigration enforcement means to these children and their educators. In what follows, you will hear their findings with vivid examples about the challenges that these children encountered living under the fear of being separated from their family members. A lot of them are American citizens, and they faced the challenges of absenteeism, trauma, bullying, among other things. Patricia and Zhang Yang also discussed various innovative ways that educators come up with to support these students, including the idea of sanctuary schooling. They offer informative suggestions to educators and policymakers. Their work also engages the general public in understanding the profound challenges schools and educators are facing today. Now, let's turn to Patricia and Zhang Yang, the authors of Schools Under Siege. So hello, Patricia and Zhang Yang. Welcome to New Books in Education. Also, congratulations on publishing such an important and timely book. So as we always do in New Books in Education, we ask our guest authors to introduce themselves first before we dive into the book. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about yourself and who you are? What's your passion? What brought you to work on this project?
Well, I'll begin. I'm Patricia, or Patricia Gandara, and I'm on the faculty at UCLA, and I'm co-director of the Civil Rights Project, Proyecto de Derechos Civiles. I come to this over a career-long span of time in which I've studied Latino students and English learners, immigrant students, and as I've got over the last several years, certainly the situation with these young people who we call English learners has become acutely problematic because, in fact, for the children of immigrants, and immigration has been under attack in this country for some time, but particularly during the last administration. And so it was really important to shift gears and think not so much about the language issues as the issues that are associated with being the child of immigrants in this country. And I will just add, Pongre, that I'm not feeling really well today. And so I may have to exit before the end of our time.
That's totally fine. And thank you for the introduction. And I'm so sorry you're not feeling well. So feel free, like we will just have a conversation about the book, and then really, like, feel free to leave. You think there's a need there? But thank you for talking with us about how you came to the project. Zhong Yong.
Thank you for the invitation, Pongfei. My name is Zhong Yong Yi, but I'm happy to go by Joy.
So I will call you Joy then.
Yeah, please. I'm an assistant professor in School of Education at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, California. Well, a little bit about myself. I'm an immigrant scholar from South Korea, meaning I have two countries that I can call home. I'm a teacher educator as well in the teacher education department, where I work with teachers and teacher scholars from traditional public charter to private schools. To speak more about my students, the majority of my students, they work in Los Angeles' most challenging school communities, serving marginalized and disadvantaged populations in many ways. And the story and experiences that we covered in our book, you know, that's my students' everyday experiences as well. Well, I would say my personal and educator identity this project that Patricia and I have dived into for the past years deeply relates to my personal and academic background.
Thank you, Joy. You know, I think I'm also an immigrant scholar, and I have been doing this interview for a while, but this topic and this book is really particularly, I found it relevant, and I found it very, you know, a lot of the concerns that teachers expressed in the book are very resonating. Mm-hmm. So let's dive in. And one thing I think I've learned from reading this book is that the impacts of immigration enforcement on children of immigrants are really like multifaceted. So it's not only about those children, and that's not to say their well-being does not matter, but it's a broader issue in profound ways related with school climates, bully issues, educational equity, and so on. Mm-hmm. So the book really offers a rich discussion on this topic. Before we start to talk about, you know, your study and, you know, some of those rich findings you presented in the book, I wonder if you could just give us a brief overview of, you know, in the most recent years, the immigration enforcement and just as the questions that you raise in the first chapter of the book, is this something new? Why or why not?
Well, I'll say a couple of words about this, that one of the themes of the book is the way fear is used to control immigrant communities and the parents and the children of immigrants. And this is nothing new, unfortunately. The last administration under President Trump was especially egregious in just how far they would go in creating fear for immigrants. But this is a recurring theme in this country, and really only more recently have we begun to look at this as something beyond simply targeting the immigrants themselves. And I'm so pleased that you picked that up from the book, that we were trying to make the point that it's a widening circle of impact, mm-hmm. starting with the immigrant family and then the children and then the teachers and then the schools and then the community. So that many, many people are affected in a very negative way by the harsh ways in which we have tried to control immigration. Joy?
Yeah, I just want to add a few things what Patricia just mentioned. And I'm going to just focus on a more recent context. So during the first phase of the Obama administration, the number of deportations was simply astronomical, you know, but the target was very specific, focusing on those who had criminal records. Under the Trump administration, however, the target of deportations became more broad, and basically those who were undocumented, regardless of their criminal records, they were the victims and the targets of the aggressive immigration enforcement activities like randomized raids and abrupt deportations, things like that. So on top of this, like what just Patricia mentioned, the way the Trump administration framed immigrants and conducted deportations was also demonizing all immigrants, dismantling their lives, of so many people, you know, living, working, and raising their U.S. citizen children in the United States for decades. And I would say, you know, more importantly, the Trump government's discourse around immigration and immigrants has been dividing the country over this topic, which is still affecting many communities across the nation, which is really a painful.
Yeah, I'll follow up on that just a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
That, in fact, one might be inclined to think that this is something in the past now because we have a new administration that thinks very differently about immigration. Mm-hmm. But the trauma that has been experienced by these children and these families in particular is not going away overnight. I mean, these students are still living with this kind of trauma. And although the federal government has shifted its focus around immigration enforcement, we still have in place across the country relationships between local police department, police force, and federal immigration officials so that local police work hand in hand. And depending on local attitudes, much of this is still going on in communities around the country.
Mm-hmm. That's such a sobering story to hear. And I understand that this is still the reality that many of us are facing right now, and many of the educators are trying to address. Being overworked, while, you know, doing a lot of things that to support their students. So I want to bring up the topic about education here. You know, I think public education for the past many years has been playing an important role in trying to integrate immigrants and their children into the fabric of American society. And now with this enforcement of, you know, immigration, and with, as you said, Patricia, about this partnership and everything we are facing right now. So what are some of the impacts? Maybe we could just go directly into this, you know, key question that you are asking in this book. How do, you know, public education and how do children, students and educators, how have they been impacted by the enforcement of immigration?
Well, I think in just a moment that Joy will describe for us the survey that we did and mm-hmm. some of the key findings from that. I'll just sort of kick it off by saying that of the 3,600 people who responded to us, that they had experienced immigration enforcement in their schools, more than 80% said that they had seen this in their own classrooms or with their own students acting out or unable to cope with lessons in the classroom because they were so terrified about what may be going on at home. Joy, you want to expand on that?
I think we can also discuss the findings a little bit later, but I just want to go back to Pengfei's the question about the role of education, especially in the public school context. Well, I think given the growing diversity in globalization we are experiencing, I think schools must play central roles in integrating students from different backgrounds in terms of race, ethnicity, religion, culture, socioeconomic status, and immigration status as well. By law, we require students to receive a certain level of public education. Therefore, students and children must spend a substantial time of their earlier lives in school. That means school is not only a place where they can learn math and science, which is a very critical part of schooling, of course, delivering knowledge, but also a school should be a place beyond that. We really need to understand that a school is an essential part of a student's lives and should be a place where they can develop foundational social skills and expand their understanding of other people in the world, whether they are from immigrant families or not. So I think this is a time for us to think about what is a basic responsibility and the fundamental role of public education as we are experiencing growing diversity and globalization in 2021 and in the future as well.
Yeah, thank you, Joy. And I can see here, how the topic about diversity and how the topic about mobilization have been integrated into the book and really make me think about, the children of immigrants, they really come from a variety of life paths, a lot of different cultural backgrounds, and they bring with them huge diversity, and they are, here to really try to, they are a very vibrant and valued part of our public education. Mm-hmm. We have been trying to think about the findings, and maybe we should ask you to first of all describe how you explore this topic, because it sounds like such an important and challenging topic to explore. I'm trying to see, for example, how can we, going back to the topic that Patricia brought up about fear, mm-hmm. I don't know how, as a researcher myself, I was asking myself, how should I, for example, if I were supposed to study this topic, where should I start, for example?
Well, I think that's a challenging topic, for a researcher, but I think we can, I can start with how we embarked on this project, back in 2017. So Patricia and I, we started working on this project in 2017 to explore what was going on in schools across the nation. And since there were some kind of limitations in using the administrative data to look into this kind of topic, we were supposed to develop and distribute our own educator survey. So we used our networks, and we also received the incredible support from our colleagues across the nation. So we reached out to numerous school districts and some educator networks from West Coast to East Coast. And very fortunately, we ended up having more than 30,600 educators from 760 schools. And actually, you know, 760 schools, you know, those schools, you know, that include only identifiable, you know, school names. And there are some participants who couldn't leave their, you know, school information or, you know, couldn't share, you know, their school information. So I think with those numbers, I believe we reached out, you know, around 800 schools in our data. And they came from, you know, different states, 13 states, actually. So when it comes to, you know, different states and educators, you know, working in different, you know, locations, and obviously, you know, varying levels of impact of immigration enforcement and support, you know, about, you know, the immigrant or students from immigrant families existed from context to context. So through this data collection process, we made sure that we had a good representation among educators from four census regions, that is West, Midwest, South, and Northeast. And we also made sure that we had participants from blue and red states as well, so that we can deliver, you know, more extensive and comprehensive understanding from educators in different political contexts.
Yeah, I think I will make just one point here that oftentimes surprises people. In all the work I've done around English learner students, students who speak another language at home, many people are shocked that these children of immigrants are in fact native-born citizens. I say, mm-hmm. Well, you know, how right. is it possible yes. that they're English learners, but they're native-born? Something close to 90% of the children of immigrants are actually born in this country, and they have full citizenship rights. And therefore, we begin this investigation with the notion that these terrible things that are happening to these young people as a result of these enforcement procedures is happening to children who have every right to be in this country, to study, to live out their lives here as US citizens. Now, those who are not documented or not born in this country are still, according to our constitution, to be given a full free education all the way through high school. But it's important for people to understand that this is the future of our country. These are our citizen kids that are undergoing this this tremendously negative experience in their schooling.
Mm-hmm. I just want to piggyback what Patricia mentioned. So I think in our project, both, you know, book project and a published article, we did emphasize the important statistics about these students and children. There are about 6 million K-12 children and students who live with undocumented family members in the United States. And in our larger context, we have about 17.8 million immigrant students. And I also want to underscore the fact that, you know, as Patricia just mentioned, the absolute majority of them, closely 90%, they are US citizens. And for those who are undocumented, you know, numerous individuals study and work benefiting from the DACA program that was introduced by the Obama administration. But not many people know about these statistics. And I just want to add just one more point. In our political conversations, these students have been usually invisible or voiceless. So as we were working on this project and study, Patricia and I, we did hope that, you know, our book and the research findings can highlight these students and children who have been invisible in our society. So
I see. Yeah. So thank you so much for like clarifying this point. And I think it's very important for people to realize the fact that honestly, you know, even for me, I'm an educational researcher, but even for me, like when we think about, you know, those immigration issues, we know that, you know, DACA students, for example, they have received relatively more attention in the past several years. And we understand them a little bit better, like their experience and the challenges they are facing. But I think one thing that we always and we tend to ignore are these students who live under fear, who live under this unbearable pressure and fear that, you know, one day they may all of a sudden being separated from their family members, could be very close family members, right? Like their parents and their grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I hope that everybody who reads this book reads it with the same sense that you have, because you are really hitting exactly on the issues that we were trying to get at.
Oh, thank you.
The invisibility of these students. And we do mention that, I mean, people tend to know a little bit more about DACA, and I, you know, nobody could be more on their side than Joy and myself. I mean, they deserve better treatment. They deserve citizenship. But these 6 million young people, these 6 million students that that Joy tells us about, have been largely invisible. Nobody's talking about them. And of course, that was the, you know, driving reason why we wanted to get this book out into the public.
Well, that's so important. And I literally, like, I feel them. I mean, I think it's such a great pressure. And it suggests it's so unfair that they need to deal with this at a young age, so much younger, and they are supposed to, I mean, just enjoy their childhood, adolescence, right?
Yeah, and as other researchers have pointed out, this can be a lifelong trauma. This is something that young people don't get over overnight or even ever sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. So Joy, Patricia, would you like to share more about those detailed and rich findings? I mean, 6 sure. million people, this is not a small number, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that this is a perfect segue for us to discuss some findings that we found important. In the survey questionnaire we developed, we focused on 4 major areas, like students expressing psychosocial stress, academic challenges, school and classroom climate, and parental involvement. And we also asked how educators responded to these issues individually or at the school level. Also, we gave survey participants an opportunity to elaborate on their experiences and thoughts in an open-ended question. And we basically received thousands of comments we found heartbreaking and painful. And we discussed these comments in chapter 4 in our book. But I will jump into some of the important findings. And Patricia, please feel free to jump in, you know, if you want to add more. So in our survey findings, about 85% of respondents reported observing students' overt expressions of fear of an ICE intervention in their lives. with nearly 40% saying this was extensive. And these concerns stood out particularly in schools located in urban communities where many immigrant populations are concentrated. And I think we shared one devastating story in chapter 4 about a student who came back after the prom, but wouldn't talk or, talk to anyone or, eat anything. The educator of this student didn't know what happened to this poor student at that time, but later she found that this student's mom got deported, even without having a chance to say goodbye to each other.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and on a similar vein, about 80% of educators in our survey reported observing emotional and behavioral issues among their immigrant students. And many described this issue as interfering with students' ability to focus on instruction. And again, as we discussed in chapter 4, some students arrived at school crying after observing their family members get deported, which is a huge trauma that can never be healed for their entire life. And these students feeling terrified emotionally and psychologically, and again, they wouldn't talk to anyone or, eat anything, participate in class, focus on the lessons either. So that ruined, the experiences that these students can have, in schools. Well, in addition, many high school educators mentioned their best students giving up their college going plans or decreasing their commitment to schools. Even, thinking about dropping out of school, to get a job to help their family members because their futures were uncertain, given what was going on at the time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I just want to interject that the teachers oftentimes mentioned that these were among their best students. They're students who were really working hard to get to college. Mm-hmm. I'd like to mention one thing here too before Joy goes on, because one can imagine what that personal trauma is like when a family member is taken away, and as Joy was explaining, that it's important for people to understand that the students around them, oftentimes not immigrant students, were oftentimes almost equally affected by this image that I have carried with me since we did this study, of the empty chair or the empty desk as the students file into class, and the kid who was their best friend or part of their social group for years, somebody who they cared about deeply, from one day to the next is gone and nobody knows what has happened to him or her. It's traumatizing for all of the students in the classroom and beyond. And that was one of the messages that we felt we really wanted to get across, is how this trauma just moves in a widening circle around the students who are affected.
I just want to add on another important finding following what Patricia mentioned. So another important finding that we want to emphasize in our book project is that about 60% of educators reported increasing absenteeism. So absences affect the schools from individual to institutional levels. Schools lose funding and resources because average daily attendance is used to calculate to support the school funding for individual student, individual schools. And because the school funding affects the quality of education, teaching staff, and resources and so forth, it also creates a vicious circle of underachievement. If they find it impossible to improve their test scores and narrow achievement gaps, and therefore, you know, they're going to be labeled as failing schools. And it's immensely challenging to break down this ongoing vicious circle, especially for Title I schools with insufficient resources. And there are other repercussions. Teacher assignments are going to be disrupted by funding and average daily attendance as well. And teachers, you know, they can lose their jobs when student enrollment is not sustainable. And there are some other, you know, institutional factors, you know, that affect, you know, schools and school districts as well. You know, when this issue, you know, gets bigger and more, you know, comprehensive.
So that sounds like, I don't know. I mean, after hearing your stories, I just feel like, why? Why do we need to be so brutal to our kids?
Well, I will add too that a big concern of ours was the impact. It didn't start out as big of a concern, but it began to grow as we began to read the comments from teachers, that teachers were being deeply affected by this. Teachers care about their students, and when terrible things are happening to their students and their students' families, and students are disappearing or students are unable to get a hold of themselves emotionally, teachers are deeply affected. And we're experiencing a shortage of teachers across the country right now. And we could talk briefly too about the pandemic and the impact
that's. Oh yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah.
But one of the questions we had in our own mind is, how is this affecting teachers? And are they going to just give up on teaching because it's just too difficult of a job? Mm-hmm. And one of our chapters is focused on that, on the impact on teachers and how this is overstressing them.
Yeah, and that's definitely what I got from hearing your words, Patricia, and what Joy just talked about, you know, the findings and, you know, how directly this may influence or impact children of immigrants and other children, but also indirectly, this may, you know, impact the schools and the teachers and, you know, the resources that are supposed to allocate to different schools in different ways. Mm-hmm. So Joy, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the Title I school, because I think that's one important chapter in the book. And I'm not sure, like, you know, if our audience will be, we'll have a like clear enough, you know, understanding about what's going on there.
Well, we focused on Title I schools in its context because often immigrant families and immigrant students, they're concentrated in this Title I schools, struggling with multi-layered issues and problems for decades. So in our finding, in our survey and educators' comments as well, we found Title I schools compared to their non-Title I school counterparts There are more increasing issues and concerns about the impact of immigration enforcement activities, the impact on, you know, educators and students. It's more, you know, devastating, you know, compared to non-Title I context where there are more funding and resources, not just, you know, material, you know, resources. It's more about political power and voices that those educators and parents have at the community level. But compared to non-Title I schools, educators and schools, students in Title I schools, they are more likely to experience increasing levels of concern, stress, anxiety when it comes to the impact of harsh immigration enforcement activities and policies.
So it sounds like Title I schools are disproportionately impacted by this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then this would be like an issue of equity.
Right. And one of the reasons we highlighted Title I school context in a separate way, focusing on just one chapter, you know, to discuss issues around Title I schools. Because we believe that, you know, now is the time, you know, and now, you know, more than ever, we really need to drive our message home on our priorities for policymakers to ensure a fair and equal education for all students, whether they are in Title I schools or non-Title I schools. And when it comes to deciding our priorities, I believe our research findings can be used as really compelling evidence to advance discussions around more support for Title I schools and students from immigrant families. And at the same time, I think you know, those discussions are very important, but I want to see some actions taking place immediately to ensure, you know, important educational rights of millions of students and children in the nation.
Indeed, Joy, it's great you mentioned this issue about, you know, making something happen at this moment and how urgent it is. I think this is something we can talk more in terms of the impact of COVID-19. And, you know, the educational landscape just changed so much in the past 2 years, and, you know, the remote education, everything. So maybe you could give us a little bit of, you know, like updates on how these children of immigrants have been doing during the pandemic. And it's still going on. And then there is another issue of, you know, we are perhaps having this policy window here that, you know, we may have some resources, local school districts may have some resources to really do something for those kids. So I want to hear your policy advocates as well, but maybe we can start with the impact of the pandemic.
I can start, and maybe Patricia can add other points as well. The pandemic crisis and its repercussions have exacerbated many students' education, especially, you know, education for students from immigrant families, as well as educators, you know, working with them as well. Especially in marginalized and disadvantaged communities. Well, I would say students have observed some of their family members dying or getting severely ill due to COVID. And maybe they have seen, you know, some family members losing jobs or struggling with financial issues. In many cases, students from immigrant families, they also need to be caregivers for their younger siblings, especially when their parents are not home, you know, to work. And that was particularly true, you know, during the lockdown phase, you know, when schools switched to virtual learning. And when it comes to virtual learning, you know, we have seen technology disparities as well, including the lack of stable internet connection, laptops and computers, and relevant to human support, you know, regarding how to use and navigate, you know, the kind of device effectively. So this kind of technology gap, you know, stands out, you know, among students from immigrant families, particularly from, you know, low-income families. And these gaps and disparities have affected these students and their, you know, educational outcomes in many ways, which, you know, turns out to be learning gaps. And I'm not sure, you know, if we can fill in these learning gaps in the near future, you know. But I would say more importantly, these students have been traumatized, as Patricia mentioned earlier, you know, by the loss of their family members and community members due to COVID. And they have been left behind in terms of social and emotional support that needs to take place at certain ages, right? And I'd say it's a more critical issue than, you know, learning gaps that many schools are trying to catch up, you know, these days. So when it comes to the different, you know, types of issues around, you know, COVID-19 and pandemic crisis, I want to emphasize again that, you know, these problems refer to educators, because they're in charge of working individual students and tracking down, you know, their learning trajectory and other things on a daily basis. So many educators have reported that they are burnout and have expressed their conditions, like, you know, emotionally, mentally, and physically drained. So we really need to start, you know, a conversation, immediate conversations around how to support, you know, these educators and students, you know, from low-income families, as well as immigrant families as well, so that, you know, we can fill in the gaps and disparities that have been widening over the pandemic crisis.
Joy, I will just simply add that the children of immigrant families, in which some or all of the members are not documented, are wildly disproportionately considered to be essential workers. They're the people working in the meat packing plants and in the agriculture and providing backup for healthcare. And so these, it's like layer on top of layer on top of layer of problems that were visited upon these students and their families. When others were able to stay home with their kids, the essential workers were not. And so they disproportionately fell victim to the COVID and with no real respite for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. I think, you know, we have seen quite some conversations about essential workers, but perhaps, you know, we could talk more, or we should visibilize more those immigrants, undocumented immigrants who have been really working hard to make sure that the city is running and make sure that, you know, like we still have food to buy from grocery stores, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm going to leave you now.
Sure. Yeah.
Joy can explain anything about this. I would just like to add, though, before I leave, that if there's the opportunity to dig in at all around the critical role that community-based organizations play and how they're filling some of these gaps that otherwise the schools simply could not do. And as Joy was talking about the need to fund these programs for these students, it's obviously the federal government, the state governments need to step up and do more, but they also need to support these community-based organizations that are really part of the fabric of these communities that are providing resources for these kids. And thank you very much, Pongfei, for the opportunity to talk about this book. And I deeply appreciate how carefully you read the book and came away with the messages exactly what we were hoping for. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor to have you here, Patricia. And we really wish you a speedy recovery. Thank you for doing this important work. So Joy, let's continue then. I will just pick it up from where Patricia left, which is the community organizations. Mm. I think I've heard some discussions about the community organizations, but I would very much like to hear more about their role in terms of supporting the children and in terms of partnering with schools.
Yeah, so when it comes to supporting students from immigrant families, while we had numerous conversations with educators in different locations and context, we found that, the trust between immigrant families and organizations that could be schools and churches and some community-based organizations in certain communities is incredibly important. Otherwise, these immigrant families, they wouldn't share their personal information, especially when it comes to immigration status, things like that. Because you never know, when the race, ICE race, would take place, whether it'll be, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, things like that. So the trust is an immensely important part, working with students from immigrant families and immigrant families in general. So we found that, a lot of local community-based organizations, CBOs across the nation, they have closely worked with students from immigrant families when it comes to offering more specific legal information or other kind of information, when it comes to going to colleges, where to get funding, where to get scholarship, fellowship, things like that. So under the Trump administration, unfortunately, there is some kind of a distrust between students from immigrant families and some schools, because these immigrant families, they tended to see schools as like public institutions, which is not a reliable, conversation partner, to share, their immigration status and status. So I think it's important, for us to restore, this trust again between immigrant families and schools as institutions. And I think when it comes to restoring, this trust again, it is fundamentally important, for schools to work with local community-based organizations hand in hand, to develop more strategic and targeted support plans to help, students from immigrant families and these families in general. And also we need to think about, the roles of the school district and the State Department of Education, because, in some context, it's too challenging for individual educators and individual schools to take the lead, to develop the relationship between local CBOs and develop, strategic plans, helping, students from immigrant families. And I would say, it's also important for us to think about more supportive system in society. So we should really go beyond the screws. At the end of the day, you know, we all need to work together, you know, to help our children and students from, you know, schools, community organizations, religious organizations, to society, you know. So we should put our efforts together, you know, to help, you know, students and children, whether they are from, you know, immigrant families or not. So I think it's critical for us to develop more stable social safety net, including better immigration processes, affordable housing, health insurance, and so forth. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, and Patricia also discussed the same point as well. As we have been going through this pandemic crisis, I've become more aware of the fact that how closely we depend on each other, right? From getting groceries ready on the market shelf to delivering packages, right? So I'd say we need to approach this topic in a more comprehensive way and think about what would be the social toll in the future if we ignored this issue or treated these students as if they are invisible. So now is the time for us to take actions and develop more strategic, you know, plans to support, you know, these students from immigrant families.
Thank you for sharing that, and Joy. And I would just add that, you know, for maybe also for our audience, I really appreciate about the book is, you know, I think maybe especially the second half of the book, we see a lot of discussions about the possible supports that, you know, schools, educators, teachers, and policymakers could offer and could move ahead and to support these children and to bring a better, brighter future for them. And to everyone, every societal member, mm-hmm. because, you know, as you have already demonstrated in the book, it's really not only an issue of, you know, one single immigrant family. It's right. going to have this larger effect. Mm-hmm. And I think the part about, I'm not going to ask you to, you know, repeat every suggestion you offer in the book, because I think, you know, it's a lot. And also, I believe if our audience are interested, I should leave something there for them to explore.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Really hope that, you know, they read, you know, these books, or purchasing this book would be better. But as I just mentioned, there are different ways and strategies, and sometimes we really need to be more creative. And I remember one administrator in our interview data saying, she says, you know, let's get rid of politics here, you know, let's just look at children. In many cases, educators and school leaders, they are extremely committed to protecting their, you know, students and ensuring good opportunities for them to succeed. And I believe there is always a good solution, you know, if they collaborate with local community-based organizations or churches, they can also reach out to nationwide, you know, nonprofit organizations or some kind of networks to offer, you know, information or resources to help, you know, students from immigrant families and the parents as well.
Yeah, see, like, this is what I really appreciate about the book. It's not only about the sobering facts. Mm-hmm. It's not only about how, you know, tragic it has been in terms of like how we have been treating these children, or how, you know, other children have also been traumatized by all the immigration enforcement the tightening practice of immigration enforcement, but also, you know, you offer some solutions, you offer some directions, and there are ways to really think about that and to really work on this issue. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that part. With that said, I've noticed that I have been taking quite some time from you today. And I want to, before we wrap up the conversation, I want to ask what you are working on right now. Anything connected with this topic or anything related with this book?
Educational equity has been the main theme around my research projects and agendas. So for now, I'm looking at some national data to look into hate crimes. And hopefully I can connect this topic with educational issues, especially, you know, issues around immigrant students. So, so I'm working on that project at this moment.
Cool. Is this also a collaboration with Patricia? Or is
By myself, I always, you know, benefit from, you know, Patricia's support and insights.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. And we wish you all the very best with your new endeavor. Thank you so much for taking our time to join us. It's a great pleasure to talk with you and Patricia, and we look forward to have you again next time if you have your new book published, Joy.
That'll be wonderful. Thank you for having us, Pongfei. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.